right, we have one remaining case on our docket this morning. If the clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Barton.
May it please the court, counsel. Russell Barton and Bill Bogle on behalf of the appellants, Lifeguard Benefit Services, Inc., and the Amacor Group, Inc. This is an appeal from a mandatory temporary injunction. This is a unique case because suit was brought for the very purpose of obtaining data, and the appellees sought and obtained that ultimate objective through the mandatory temporary injunction, all on the false premise that there was an immediate threat of harm from a civil investigative demand, a CID, that had been received from the Minnesota Attorney General's office. This morning, I will be talking about two different categories of information. The first is non-contested, deals with information about non-contested members, and as it implies, those are persons that there's no dispute that they are Direct Med or CASA members. The second category are contested members, and these are persons that the appellants contend are not Direct Med or CASA members. In general, the mandatory temporary injunction orders that the data regarding the non-contested members to be provided directly to the appellees, and the data regarding the contested members to be provided to a third party who is to allow the appellees to have access to it, but purportedly not to allow any copying of the information. The purpose of a temporary injunction is to maintain the status quo until trial. The actual last non-contested status preceding the controversy. The flip side of that rule is that a temporary injunction cannot be used to accomplish the ultimate objective of the lawsuit. The status quo here is that the appellees have not had access to complete credit card information and bank account numbers regarding the non-contested members, and the status quo is that the appellees have not had access to any of the information regarding the contested members. Prior to
Let me ask a clarification question. Are you saying that the appellees never had access to what I would call, I guess, the uncontested files and records regarding credit card information?
Not the complete numbers.
Okay.
You know, way back when, because Mr. Brueggemann started all three of these entities, you know, to the extent it was kind of an alter ego situation, well, maybe so, but since the merger in 2007, the evidence is that the status quo at the preceding this controversy is that complete credit card numbers had not been provided.
So Lifeguard has clients other than just Direct Medical and CASA.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. The contested member information is unrelated to Direct Med. These are products or services that are not Direct Med products. There's evidence in the record about a plan called Lifeguard Health Solutions. Doesn't have anything to do with Direct Med. The issue with respect to that and what is disputed or contested is whether those customers are CASA members. And that becomes important when we get to the irreparable harm issue here in a minute. The temporary injunction alters
the issue of people being associated are CASA members, doesn't it? I read in the briefs there was more than one statement that the people who were supplied health benefits by the Lifeguard were told that those were being presented as a consequence of their being associated with CASA. Is that accurate or is that not accurate?
Well, with respect to the contested information, the documents do, and again, these are unrelated to Direct Med, the documents do purport to reflect that a CASA membership is involved. I think the evidence shows that the process for that is the customers never see that information until after they have become a customer. They enroll over the telephone. They're not charged any additional fee or premium with respect to CASA. And part of the dispute and why it's a contested issue deals with, in fact, should those be considered to be CASA customers or not?
And that's what you contend is an ultimate fact to be decided at the time of trial on the case as opposed to something done on temporary injunction.
That is one of the ultimate issues. That's correct.
What role, you're talking about three entities, and I'm reading as I look at the briefs that there are five entities. You got Direct Medical, you have Consumer Assistance, Services Association, and then you've got Lifeguard, and then you've got a USHBG, two nonprofits, and three profits. What role does USHBG have in this entity, in this dispute?
I am not exactly sure, Your Honor, other than they may be involved in the call center activity. The parties to the lawsuit are the plaintiffs, are the appellees, Direct Medical, and CASA, and the defendants are Lifeguard Benefit Services and the Amacor Group. The temporary injunction alters the status quo in a number of ways. With respect to the non-contested members, it provides access, direct access, to the full credit card and bank account numbers, and it requires the data to be provided in a format that was not previously utilized. With respect to the contested members, it allows access to the data to the appellees through this third party. Significantly, paragraph 4 of the temporary injunction requires that the daily updates of the contested member data is to be provided directly to the appellees instead of by a hard drive to the third party. Clearly, that provides the ultimate relief sought by the appellees with respect to that data. Puts it right in their hands. Now, it's my understanding that Mr. Troutman may agree that paragraph 4 is wrong and should not be implemented as it's worded, but the appellant should not be placed in a position of having to reach an agreement so as to not be forced to comply with an improper injunction.
I have a question, maybe kind of off the wall, but I'm wondering, because this was a suit for a deck action, breach of contract, and conversion, and this temporary injunction to me almost seems in the nature of a discovery order. I'm wondering kind of how we got to the, why is it a temporary injunction instead of just a discovery order where protective mechanisms could be imposed, and I'm wondering how we got here.
Your Honor, I cannot answer that. The plaintiffs didn't ask for this separation into contested versus non-contested. The as far as I know, the trial court, when sending out the letter after the injunction hearing, came up with that. It does, clearly, a temporary injunction cannot be used as a discovery order. By its very terms, that changes the status quo. A discovery order does. And the discovery rules do allow for mechanisms, as Your Honor points out, to preserve the party's rights, whether that be by redacting information, whether that be attorney's eyes only, and This order does not do that. It provides direct access. And
the relief sought, we don't have the benefit of having the motion for temporary injunction before us at this minute, but the relief sought in that was the relief granted.
The relief sought in the motion and in the pleadings is we want access to everything, okay, with no distinction being made.
So the motion for temporary injunction specifically sought access.
Correct.
Thank you.
We've cited the court, and the law is clear. We've cited the court to a couple Supreme Court cases, and this court's opinion in the City of Arlington versus City of Fort Worth case, that when the central issue is whether the status quo is wrongful, and that is exactly what the appellees are claiming here. They're claiming the status quo is a breach of contract and a conversion. And the cases say that when the central issue is whether that status quo is wrongful, a temporary injunction is not proper because it essentially adjudicates the issue without a trial on the merits. And that's exactly what the injunction does. On page one of the injunction, under parentheses number one, the trial court made a finding that plaintiffs will be denied possession of the data, information, and records regarding DirectMed and CASA members to which they have the right of possession. That's the central issue to have a trial about. And the trial court has adjudicated it after a one-day injunction hearing. As with any temporary injunction, the appellees were required to prove an imminent threat of irreparable harm. And because this is a mandatory temporary injunction, there must also be a clear and compelling showing of extreme hardship or necessity. The appellees rely on the CID to claim that there was an irreparable harm here. The evidence at the hearing established that the Attorney General's office had granted an extension of time to respond and that there was no set deadline to respond to the CID. There was no threat of or an imminent threat of any harm from the Attorney General's office.
But wasn't there some evidence indicating that there wasn't just this one investigation, but there were multiple state investigations to which the appellees had been provided no information?
The evidence is a number of complaints had been made. The testimony was that there was concern about potential investigations that may happen in the future. And that clearly is not evidence of an imminent threat of irreparable harm. There's no evidence that the Attorney General's office is seeking the full credit card numbers and bank account numbers. The CID itself allows for objections to be asserted. And there's no evidence that any were made. The clerk's record at page 112 shows that the appellant's lifeguard asked the appellees to assert privacy objections and to seek an agreed protective order from the Attorney General's office. There's no evidence that any of that happened.
Mr. Barton, I have a follow-up on that. In terms of what the record or what the brief of appellees says on page 8, I want to see if you agree with this statement. Those complaints, it's talking about complaints now that were furnished as a part of a Rule 11 agreement, that certain documents were furnished that showed complaints from Pennsylvania, Texas, Wisconsin, Virginia, Ohio, New Hampshire, New York, Arkansas, Missouri, and Illinois, and that those complaints were processed by your client, felons. I mean by your client, without using direct mail letterhead and without the knowledge of that police. Did that happen?
The complaints were responded to by Lifeguard, which is what they were supposed to do pursuant to the agreements. If you read the CASA services agreements, in essence, CASA is nothing. It has no employees. It has nothing. And the services agreement provides Lifeguard to do it all, to run the business.
Then do you agree with the statement, further, a portion of those were signed by an individual holding himself out as an assistant secretary of Direct Med, which was a position that he never held?
The testimony at the hearing was Mr. Brueggemann testifying as to his knowledge prior to the merger of what position that individual held. I think he admitted that he had no knowledge whether the board of directors of the appellants had appointed that person to that office.
My concern is just whether there was action being taken by your clients in responding to complaints from all of these various states whereby someone was holding himself out as a officer of Direct Med, which was not an accurate statement.
Yeah, and our position is that Lifeguard, under the agreements, was entitled and had in the past responded to complaints of that nature, and to my knowledge, that gentleman was fully authorized to respond to,
thank you, sir,
to the complaints. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barton. Mr. Troutman?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel. Your Honor, I want to begin with the last point that Your Honor was addressing. Lifeguard had no authority to appoint officers for Direct Med. Direct Med's a separate company, was not part of the merger, and this individual that held himself out as assistant secretary never had that authority, never was in that position, and that was the point. So they were answering these various and numerous complaints without the knowledge of Direct Med. And so the court is aware, USHBG, the way that the companies are set up, if you will, CASA is a nonprofit association which has policies written to it and other benefits that it has contracted for its members. It handles its work. Direct Med is a brand. So when somebody buys the Direct Med product, they get a group. I'll use a number of 40. I don't know the exact amount. Let's say 40 different benefits, whether it's a limited medical benefit, it's not health insurance, or some other lifestyle-type benefits. That's the Direct Med product. All Direct Med customers are then members of CASA because CASA is the policyholder. It is sold through USHBG as the call center. That is the method by which it's sold, and USHBG is a wholly owned subsidiary of Amacor. So back in 07, Amacor decided they wanted to purchase Lifeguard to get the Lisa system. At that point, they were saying, and now it may be different, but they merged with Lifeguard and took it over. Prior to that time, Mr. Brueggemann was the CEO of all of these companies, and they bought only Lifeguard. Prior to that time, Mr. Brueggemann, as CEO of all these companies, had full and complete, and the word unfettered, access to all of the information in the Lifeguard system, the Lisa system, which included necessarily credit card information, just any and all information. The point as well that I'd like to stress is that the reason Lifeguard has any of this information, any of it at all, is because Direct Med and CASA have contracted with Lifeguard to do what Lifeguard does for them. So they have the customer information. It's not that you've seen the agreements. It's not Lifeguard's customers. They're basically handling backroom operations on behalf of Direct Med and CASA.
But do they not handle, quote, backroom operations on behalf of any other entities?
They do. But that's not, that information, that other information, is not part of the order. It would not be anything they would have to turn over. The contested CASA members.
But I thought I understood that even if they sold a product for another entity, that the person purchasing that product would then automatically become a member of CASA.
Not in all instances, Your Honor. It's Lifeguard Health Options is the company that comprises what we've called the contested CASA members. During the course of things as this case began, it became known that Lifeguard and Amacor were selling a product, just like DirectNet is a product. Well, they created another product, lumped a bunch of benefits together, I'll call it, and included in that contract, if you will, with their customers, statements all over the document, which your honors have as well in the exhibits. Welcome to CASA. You're now a member. You're entitled to membership in CASA because of your purchase of Lifeguard Health Options. So that became what's called the contested CASA members. Now that's the information. When you talk about whether the trial court violated the rules pertaining to the orders, that information isn't given to us. We're given to it in essence so that we can see and determine what's there, but we're not entitled to use that for anything other than the litigation purposes. The Minnesota.
Well, you still have it if you get it for litigation purposes. I don't follow how you're saying you don't have it.
Well, I think with regards to the data that I'll call the DirectMed data, that is our data, the data that we can do with what we will, that we're entitled to. We're entitled to audit the books that the agreements say that your honors have as well. That information, we could contact clients. We could seek to sell them other products. We could bill those clients. We could do anything we wanted to do with regards to those clients. They're our clients. We can't do that with regards to the contested CASA members. We can't do anything with regards to that. When counsel speaks of our right to...
Why should you be entitled to access to the information concerning the contested CASA members?
Because the CID, Your Honor, talks about CASA and what CASA, how CASA works with DirectMed. That's what the Minnesota Attorney General's office is seeking.
But the contested CASA members are not working with DirectMed. There are CASA members that were pulled into CASA through the purchase of a different product other than a DirectMed product. So that's where I'm not seeing how that's relevant to the CID.
The Minnesota CID, Your Honor, in our opinion, to fully answer the Minnesota Attorney General's request, we needed that information so we could determine if CASA was involved. While it's directed to DirectMed, the CID, it's our opinion that because of the nature of how this works, CASA and DirectMed are so closely connected that this other CASA Lifeguard Health Options plan that was sold involving CASA, we feel is necessary to get that information so we can determine whether Minnesota consumers were misled as to that information. That's why we think.
But isn't that a determination for the Minnesota Attorney General? I mean, they can get the data and look at it and determine if they want to broaden the scope of their investigation. But right now, it's DirectMed.
Well, right now it's directed to DirectMed with has inquiry about CASA in the CID. So that's why we felt it was necessary when we learned that CASA was also here in the Lifeguard Health Options to get that information so we could fully answer with regards to the CID. That's why we sought that, Your Honor.
I understand your position. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regards to the status quo, we have three arguments. We have the one that I mentioned earlier about Mr. Bergerman, when he was representing all of the companies, had full access. The word unfettered was used without objection, in fact, consented to, in the Rule 11 agreement, which is the second reason the status quo, actually I take that back, the second is the web-based portal that was provided. If you notice that it was provided when the CID was served, recognizing that there was a potential issue here, Lifeguard immediately then said, well, now we'll give you access again to your information through the web-based portal, but it was limited and ultimately shut down. Then after the lawsuit was filed, it was agreed with the Rule 11 agreement that we would be provided the data that we're seeking. And, in fact, we were provided data, but it was corrupted data, which was uncontroverted at the trial. So our position is when you look at the three areas that I've just spoke of, that is the status quo, that we were entitled and getting data. Whether the time is is the issue, the time of the, from counsel's point of view, the time between October of 2007 and July of this year, his contention is, well, Mr. Bergerman was no longer the CEO of all the companies, and we restricted him from getting access to the data between those time periods. So, therefore, that is now the status quo.
So are you saying the status quo is really recognizing and implementing the Rule 11 agreement?
I'm suggesting,
regardless of what the underlying contractual arrangements are.
I'm suggesting that your honors can look at it, at that as the status quo, or you can look at the web-based portal as the status quo, or you can look at the contracts which require and that it's and recognize it's our data and give us the right to the data, to possession of the data, or you can look at the October 2007 and prior workings of the companies where Mr. Brueggemann, as CEO, had full access to every aspect of the Lisa system, which they created. This wasn't an off-the-shelf thing. They created it and implemented it and had they could go in there and do whatever they wanted to do. So I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that you can look at any one of those or look at them in combination and say the status quo was the direct Met and CASA had access to their data. You cut them off from access. The immediate and irreparable harm is because you have an attorney general's office saying we're opening a fraud investigation. And that's why, you know, Lifeguard offered to answer on behalf of DirectMed, which was rejected, and then the suit was filed.
Is there any evidence indicating what the other complaints from the other states, are they fraud issues if it's in the record?
Your Honor, I believe, and I don't have all of them committed to memory, but the various complaints, I think that the tenor that runs through them is allegations of fraud. In other words, they're saying basically if to the common thread, if you will, running through them is you told us it was one thing, it's another. We want our money back, and we haven't gotten it back in sufficient time or whatever it may be. There's variations, but the gist of it is this isn't what it was represented to be, which goes back to USHBG because they are the ones who make the contacts and sell the product in the name of DirectMed as a CASA membership. DirectMed and CASA go hand in hand, really. There's other, as we see, brands, if you will, that are connected to CASA, but that's the one that's at issue here.
So how do you respond to their assertion that continuing or allowing the trial court's order to be implemented is not granting the ultimate relief requested by trial?
Your Honor, there are four counts in our complaint, including counts for damages. The first count is the declaratory judgment. The contested CASA in and of itself sets apart that aspect of the claims that we don't get full relief as to the contested CASA. That's an item for trial. So when you look at the four causes of action, there are damage claims in there, conversion claims. It doesn't grant all of the relief. And counsel and the appellants argue that all we wanted was data. Well, the complaint that's been filed states otherwise. And it doesn't, and either way, it doesn't give us everything because of the contested CASA members.
Mr. Troutman.
Yes, Your Honor.
What contract is there with Amamor?
There is no contract between either DirectMed and CASA along with Amamor.
All right. So when Amamor is one of the defendants against whom a temporary restraining order is issued, there's not any basis for issuing a temporary restraining order against them if they're not part of the database that you're attempting to gain access to and you have no contractual agreement with them.
I don't necessarily agree with Your Honor on that, but my response would be that we brought Amamor in believing them to, well, certainly they control Lifeguard at this point, USHBG, and all of the data, they control it. They're the parent company.
We're talking about a database, aren't we?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're talking about a database that is an asset owned by Lifeguard.
The software, to my knowledge, it's been rebranded as Amamor. If you see,
I'm not worried about the software.
Right.
The database is the information that's within that database may have access granted to it by the use of software, but what we're talking about here is an asset that was transferred out of the control of the companies that you represent and the people involved with whenever that company's control was changed by a merger with Amamor.
The database, Your Honor, the data that is in the system belongs to DirectMed and CASA. The contracts are clear that it is our information. It must be turned over upon back to us upon termination of the contract.
And I follow that fully. I'm right. All the way down to the point of, okay, how do you differentiate between the members of CASA that the court says, okay, that information goes to them directly, and the contested members goes to a third party to be handled for
right.
the limited purposes as stated in the temporary
right.
injunction. But at that point, where it gets mixed is the contracts are not explicit in defining what is a CASA member or a CASA data information that belongs to CASA. Your contracts don't define a contested member in the way that the court is saying.
Well, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't because, frankly, I'm not sure when, Your Honor, it became known that Lifeguard and or Amacor through USHBG was selling a brand, and including in it a CASA membership, which they now contend is not the case, that it was put on there for some other reasons other than making them CASA members. So the agreements don't address that issue in and of itself. But the question about data, about whose data is it, that is in the contracts. And I don't know if that answers Your Honor's question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Troutman. Mr. Barton, rebuttal.
Justice Walker, you picked up on a very significant point that deals with the irreparable harm issue, and that is in his closing argument to the trial court, Mr. Troutman emphasized that the irreparable harm exists with respect to the contested member data. But the wheels fall off of that because the CID is asking for files relating to DirectMed customers, not CASA members. And none of the contested member data are DirectMed customers. So that cannot be irreparable harm. The Rodea case holds that a temporary injunction cannot go beyond alleviating the harm. Since the CID is addressed to DirectMed, the mandatory temporary injunction regarding the contested members is improper. Justice Livingston, with respect to the status quo, the Rule 11 agreement as a matter of law cannot be the status quo because it doesn't precede the controversy. It was an attempt after the lawsuit was filed. It is not the status quo.
But I don't understand, like in a suit for maybe violation of a covenant not to compete, quite often trial courts grant temporary injunctions. And the status quo at the instant it's filed is that some employee is breaching the covenant.
No.
So
that is a good point. But the distinction is in a covenant not to compete case, the status quo, the last actual non-contested status, is that there is no competition. And so a temporary injunction, a prohibitive temporary injunction, can be issued to preserve that status quo. Nobody is claiming that the status quo is wrongful there. And that's the distinction, and the City of Arlington case is a good example of that. And here, the status quo the appellees are claiming is a breach of contract and the tort of conversion. And what the cases say, you can't just adjudicate that on a temporary injunction. Justice Meyer, who owns the data or who is entitled to possession of the data? That has to be tried. And the temporary injunction short-circuits that, provides them that relief, and it's a mandatory temporary injunction. There's no evidence whatsoever of any extreme hardship or necessity. Clearly, if there's not even irreparable harm, there cannot be such extreme hardship or necessity of the type that justifies a mandatory temporary injunction.
But why, since the contested CASA clients, that data is being held by this third party, I don't see how that is actually the ultimate relief. I mean, the ultimate relief is identifying which ones are which, and then I guess ultimately fighting over whose clients they really are.
Well, first, as I pointed out before, with respect to paragraph 4, regarding these daily updates that have to be made all the way to the time of trial, it provides for that contested data to be put directly in their hands and not in the hands of the third party. It's wrong. But in any event, even providing the access to that, the fundamental problem with this is that this is an injunction directed to the appellants. It orders the appellants to do something. It does not directly order the appellees to not do anything with this data. If clearly, even with the third party, they're entitled to access, but they're purportedly, the third party somehow is supposed to keep them from copying it or disseminating it. And I don't know how the third party does that, but with respect to these contested members who we claim are our customers, all they need is a name and a town, and they can go compete for those customers. There is harm all the way around here, with whether you're talking about the contested members or the non-contested members, and we would request that the court dissolve the temporary injunction.
I have a quick question about the proper relief. Is there really an issue concerning paragraphs 1 and 2 of the injunction concerning the disclosure of the non-contested CASA? I mean, paragraphs 1 and 2, it seems like are...
There is, because it requires the complete credit card number and bank account numbers to be provided.
Okay.
And one other question. I guess the petition is still pending in the Supreme Court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as we notified the court last month, I think that court is awaiting what happens here.
And then I guess really, though, once our opinion issues, then that petition becomes moot.
That's possible, yes.
Counsel, Judge, I've got one question. I know we're past time, and I'm sorry to keep you here.
No, that's fine.
If the database contains the information that has the bank account numbers and the credit card numbers, and if the database that deals with the CASA members is a part of the information to which CASA would be entitled and DirectMed would be entitled, then how is it that they're not entitled to the full amount of that information as opposed to being only maybe a partial bit of the information, limiting out maybe the full number on the credit card? If it's an asset that they are entitled to and own the right to have access to under their contracts, why don't they get all of it instead of part of it?
That's a good question. And let me address it this way. At trial, there can be defenses raised to either contract defenses or defenses that have arisen by virtue of course of dealing, by virtue of even equity. Providing the complete customer credit card numbers in this instance puts LifeGuard at risk of breaching its credit card agreements, which restrict its right to disseminate that information. And clearly the status quo has been, I think it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 58, is an example of where some, but not all, of that credit card number is provided to the appellees.
I understand. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Barton. Mr. Troutman, thank you for your arguments today. We appreciate your briefing and your case is submitted. We will now adjourn court.
Thank you.